We now turn to the question of the day. Just how did people who lived 1,000 years ago in the Middle Ages spend their leisure time? They had no television, movies, computer games, or even radio. So just what did they do? Here to tell us all is Creighton historian Eileen Dugan and her special guest, Compton Reeves.
American leisure today is big business. We flock to big budget movies packed with special effects. We demand 200 channels of cable TV. We attend sporting events and buy merchandise related to our favorite teams and heroes. We devour the latest computer games, dreaming of defeating all competitors on the internet. We buy sport utility vehicles to get to and from our multiplying leisure activities. What does all that say about our society and about us? We are well aware that it wasn't always this way. But then we have to ask, what was it like? How did people in the past entertain themselves? And what does that say about them? With us today to discuss the hidden world of medieval leisure is Dr. Compton Reeves, professor of history at Ohio University. Dr. Reeves is the author of Pleasure and Pastimes in Medieval England. Greetings, Dr. Reeves.
Hello there.
Why, in your opinion, is the study of leisure important to our understanding of the past?
Well, I think one of the challenges that we always have, not only professional historians like myself, but particularly as we try to teach students, is to find a bridge between ourselves and the past. Past politics often seems very remote, but past leisure and discovering the people in the past, even though their lives may have been hard and difficult, managed to find time to play, just as we know in our own century that people in prisons or people in concentration camps found ways of entertaining themselves and ways to laugh. I think that if we're going to truly understand people who lived in the past, we have to know how they played as well as how they worked, how they conducted their political affairs and that sort of thing.
And how have 20th century finds contributed to the study of medieval pastimes?
Oh, well, it's contributed tremendously. First of all, I could say that simply the maturing of the academic discipline of history has been important, opening up archives and making more documents available. And by the way, there's still a tremendous amount to be done in terms of just making available documents that survive from 6, 8, 10 centuries ago. But beyond that, I think what has been very helpful and what I tried to integrate into my own work were some things concerning, physical finds, bone skates for skating on ice, the discovery of game pieces for chess or for backgammon or for other kinds of games. I think to be able to make those physical contacts with the past is also important. We all love to travel to places and see buildings and see where famous people were, but we can also go to museums and see pieces of jewelry, or we can see a manuscript that someone painted, or we can see a piece of stained glass or something like that. So these finds, not only documentary finds, but also finds of material culture, I think are extremely important in helping us bridge the gap between ourselves and the past.
Well, for most of us, the phrase medieval entertainment generally conjures up images of tournaments and jousting. What purpose did the tournament serve among the medieval nobility?
Well, the first thing to note is that tournaments did have to do with the nobility. They were very expensive pastimes to participate in because of the horses, because of the armor, because of the weapons, because of the requirement of a tremendous amount of leisure time to become the kind of athlete that it was necessary to be in order to participate, even to participate, not only to participate successfully in a tournament. The origins of tournaments have been, that's a subject that's been debated greatly, but apparently they originated in France, and basically the tournaments were training for war, training in the use of weapons from horseback, that is It's mounted, armed warfare. We call it cavalry warfare. The original tournaments were basically team sports with a team of warriors or knights on one side and a team on the other, and they would pick a day and a place and fight it out. But it soon became obvious that this was a very expensive thing. People got killed, and rulers wanted to protect their warriors. And so gradually there were introduced rules to refine tournaments. By, say, the 15th century, tournaments were pretty well regulated sports. They were still dangerous, still very expensive to participate in. Tournament armor, for example, was heavier and gave the knight less mobility so as to protect him better. But the tournaments served not only as entertainment for the nobility, I think they provided them with an opportunity to display their athletic prowess, their skill in horsemanship. Look at the upper crust of society today that plays polo. I think there's probably a certain kindred spirit there. But the tournaments were also a way of gathering the nobility together in a convivial way. And in some cases, it was an opportunity to talk politics, to talk whatever other kinds of things. So there were many functions of a tournament.
Now, of course, the tournaments did tend to be among the nobility, but in your book you discuss sports and games that medieval people of all classes enjoyed. Could you discuss some of those, please?
Oh, my gracious. I discovered all sorts of things that people played. I mentioned a moment ago some of the board games, backgammon, chess, drafts, what we in the United States would call checkers. Card games were introduced toward the end of the medieval period, and so those were some of the more quiet kinds of games. Archery, bat and ball games. I suppose the bat and ball games are as instinctive as little children with sticks and rocks that they can whack around. There don't seem to have been many rules, or rules were made up as they went along. We don't have documents about rules for ball games, but there are certainly illustrations and mentionings. I have come across a number of regulations about playing what we might call handball, by bouncing balls off of walls where church windows were being broken because people playing ball by bouncing it off near the windows of churches and things like that. Football was a popular pastime in various ways. The ancestor of what we would call in the United States soccer. And these didn't require set rules. They could be made up as the game was played, and often were rather vigorous games.
And speaking of churches, you found an illustration of monks and nuns at sport.
Oh, yeah. And I think that, if nothing else, also indicates that everyone looked for an opportunity to be distracted by some sort of pleasure or game playing, just like we are.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think that's one of the wonderful ways we can bridge the gap of time between ourselves and our medieval ancestors, to understand that they enjoyed being distracted by fun and games just like we do. And many of the games they played were similar to our own.
Yes, for example, the illustration of them playing at a bat and ball game.
Yes.
Now, what place did music have in medieval lives?
Well, music, it seems to me, was central. And it was accepted, work songs to assist, to break the tedium of heavy labor. We don't have many of these that seem to survive, but folk tunes and music are mentioned. One of my favorite mentionings of music in this context would be the poet. Well, he was a poet by avocation, but in his primary occupation he was a clerk in the office of the Privy Seal in England, Thomas Hocklieve, who made the comment that it was awfully difficult being a scribe because he had to just, as he said, stoop and stare on the sheepskin and the parchment he was writing on, and he couldn't sing like at his work like laborers could. Music was also connected to medicine. We think that musical therapy is some sort of a new 20th century innovation, but medieval physicians understood that medicine and music were connected, that, and they, for example, would take a person who was depressed and prescribe lively, gay music to stimulate them, or someone who was very excited to play soothing, quiet music. So there were all sorts of ways in which music was important to people's lives.
And did medieval people have pets?
Oh, indeed they did. I found a difficult line for me to draw, say, with pet dogs, was where does the hunting, working dog leave off and the domestic pet begin? And I'm not sure quite where to make that line, but people did have pets. Cats and dogs were very popular. Squirrels, birds, rabbits. One of my very favorite examples of a strange pet bird was Bishop Hugh of Lincoln, who ultimately was canonized, St. Hugh of Lincoln, who died in 1200. He was reputed to have a pet swan that lived at one of the Episcopal manors where Hugh spent time, and the swan would follow him around. And part of this, I imagine, was trying to illustrate what a kind, good man Hugh was, which was a part of his sanctity, because swans are rather obstreperous beasts. But this swan followed Hugh around and tried to give him peace and quiet, and ran other people off and things of that sort in the stories about him. So all kinds of pets seem to have been possible.
One theme which appears time and again in your books is the attempt by authorities, ecclesiastical, secular, to regulate pastimes, clothing, even manners. And some of their laws would appear to many of us today as being excessive, if not absurd. Why did authorities feel that such control was necessary?
I think for the same reason that we find today legislators attempting to control things that really can't be controlled by legislation. They were, for example, an authority thinking that it was, let's imagine some very pious type authority thinking that it was improper to spend time playing games when it was more appropriate to be listening to sermons, or the English government thinking that it was inappropriate to be spending time playing tennis or playing football when young men ought to really be practicing archery so that they would be available for good soldiering should it be necessary. I think part of it was the fear that any authority feels that people are not are going their own direction and not following the lead of the authority. But there was also a tremendous gap between the passing of legislation and the observance of legislation. Some of the legislation, for example, also had to do with clothing and what was appropriate to be worn by different classes and ranks in society and so on. Those laws were repeated over and over again, which, if nothing else, indicates that no one paid any attention to them.
And there was ritual protest. For example, the custom of the boy bishop at Christmas time. Can you explain that?
This, I think, is again just an expression of the exuberance that sometimes appears in the records and sometimes doesn't. And it was perhaps, in the case of the boy bishop, a way of giving an acceptable channel to the exuberance of youth. In most of the large churches, there would have been choirs that would have had young boys who would provide the high-pitched voices that were needed for the music. Here's another example of music being central to life. And those boys would be educated in the school attached to the church, but boys, being exuberant as young boys are, didn't always want to follow the lead of being sober and quiet and under control. And so there was a tradition of, in the Christmas season, having a period of time at some churches, we know for sure, at Lincoln Cathedral, for example, of a bishop, or the office of bishop being filled in a pretend way by a boy. And I wonder sometimes, too, and I don't know how this can be documented, but if this isn't another example of children imitating their elders at play. Little boys today might play cowboy or policeman or something of that sort. Little medieval boys played priest or played bishop, and here it was given recognition. And he, of course, would not be, a boy bishop would not have the powers to celebrate the Eucharist or something of that sort, but would go through rituals and celebrations and fun.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have today. Thank you very much, Dr. Reeves.
Oh, you're most welcome. There are a great many other things that we might talk about. Pleasures and pastimes are something that is perhaps universal to the human experience.
Thank you very much. We have been talking with Dr. Compton Reeves, professor of history at Ohio University, author of Pleasures and Pastimes in Medieval England.